Hi, everyone, and welcome to the podcast that we're doing today. So my name is Emmanuel, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Alex, Logan, and Eli. We will be discussing colonization and the effect it's had on sport in the Pacific Islands and how that can still be seen today. We discussed this a lot in class when we were coming up with what topic we should pursue. And through my personal connections to Pacific Islands and our mutual love of sports, we landed on this topic. So I will be specifically focusing on rugby. And what about you, Alex?
I'm on soccer.
I will be doing baseball.
And I am discussing cricket.
Awesome. Let's just dive right into it, guys. All right. So for me personally, rugby is a huge part of my family. Mm-hmm. My parents both originate from New Zealand, so I've grown up around the sport my whole life. My dad even coached rugby in France when we emigrated over to New Zealand, so definitely been exposed to it my whole life. So rugby specifically was actually introduced to the Pacific Islands during the colonial era, so that's when the British colonies started to be formed over there, and it very quickly captured the hearts of people in the Pacific Islands. British missionaries and colonial administrators in the late 19th century brought it over and introduced it mainly to smaller islands at the beginning, like Fiji, Samoa, and Tonga. Now, obviously, new things don't come without complex situations, and it did have benefits and challenges. Now, historically, colonization has kind of had those pros and cons in the Pacific. It has provided resources, infrastructure, and it really did facilitate the growth of the sport over there. Now, Britain is the main country that introduced it over there and has played a huge role in spreading it across the region. Now, England, kind of known, I think Alex would agree with me on this, for setting up the rules for a lot of sports. Yeah. We'll touch on that in a bit with soccer. And so they were big in setting up clubs and competitions and really laying that big foundation for it to become an official sport.
Yeah,
right.
But on the other hand, it's brought cultural imperialism, and it did exploit the local people quite deeply, and those are effects we can still see today. My main example that I think really does need to be discussed is how these Pacific nations have poaching occur. Now, poaching in rugby is when the local players are taken by the bigger countries and represent the bigger countries rather than their smaller nations. So if you look at big teams like New Zealand and Australia, which are some of the more talented countries for rugby in the world today, around 40 to 50% of their players actually have roots from other Pacific islands.
I did not know that.
So you've got Fiji, Samoa, and Tonga, which are these tiny, tiny islands, have their young players poached, taken over to New Zealand and Australia when they're about 10 to 11 years old.
I'm sure it'd be easy to poach them too.
Oh, super easy.
They want to elevate themselves.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it mainly happens through school. Now, when you look at these smaller, and we've discussed this in our class, smaller islands don't have the infrastructure that the larger islands like New Zealand and Australia have. So you've got these smaller children who are being offered scholarships to these top private schools in New Zealand and Australia, taken from their families at sort of 10 to 11 years old, moved to New Zealand and Australia to play rugby, because school rugby is huge in New Zealand, huge, lots of money in it. And so they're taken over, play rugby for sort of 6-7 years in school, and then when they get to 18 and they get to play nationally, they represent New Zealand and Australia rather than their original countries, Fiji, Samoa, etc.
Okay.
Now, to combat this, the World Rugby Organization is coming out and trying to go against poaching. And to do this, they have a huge plan to try and combat it, because they want it to be a more level playing field. And then through doing this, we now have rugby in the Olympics, which is very exciting. I think it's really introduced the game to the rest of the world. Well, what a lot of people don't know is rugby has different formats, not quite like American football and other sports. So rugby sevens is kind of a condensed version. It's like flag football, but smaller version. Right. So you have seven on each side rather than 15, and that is now an Olympic sport. So it's shorter, it's 7-minute halves.
Are the rules basically the
They're
same?
They're identical.
Thing,
it's just smaller teams, so 7 players on each side and 7-minute halves rather than 40-minute halves, which makes it a lot easier. You can have more games in a day. Super aerobic sport, lots of running, because obviously there's only 7 players on each side. It is now an Olympic sport, and it has allowed a lot of these other players to represent their smaller nations at the Olympics. So Fiji actually won an Olympic gold medal, first ever Olympic gold medal for Fiji in 2016 when it was debuted in Rio. So that's super exciting. It's bringing Pacific Island culture to the table for other countries to see, and bringing rugby to the table and really bringing back that pride of these younger players.
It's also exposing the island to the
world
too.
No, 100%.
It kind of helping bring rugby like around the world too.
Absolutely. Right? And I think especially for maybe countries like the US where you've got kind of that replacement sport of American football, it's been interesting for you guys to see a smaller, condensed, quite high intensity version of it. Very exciting. I mean, America actually got to the quarterfinals, I believe, at the last Olympics. So it's growing here too, which is amazing to see Pacific Island sports growing in the rest of the world. And on top of that, there's an amazing movie that I would definitely recommend for anyone listening to watch, which is Oceans Apart, Greed, Betrayal, and Pacific Island Rugby. And it follows this amazing man called Dan Leo, who really struggled fighting against the corruption in these smaller islands, because unfortunately the smaller islands get a lot of money from the bigger countries for effectively poaching their own players out. So it's this awful cycle of, do they want their players to play for them? Absolutely. But they're getting financial gains from effectively selling these young boys to the bigger islands.
And money talks, so.
Exactly. And so Dan Leo is from Samoa, and he is actually one of the people on the committee in the rugby World Rugby Organization that is really trying to combat equity amongst Pacific Islands so that people can play for where they come from. So yeah, I'll pass over to Alex to bring us on to soccer and what else Britain has exposed us to in the Pacific.
So I'll be talking about soccer, also more widely known as football around the world, but I'm going to call it soccer just because, yeah, football. So it was, soccer was first formally introduced in the UK in 1863, but you can see like this sport of kicking a round ball all the way back to the Romans and the ancient Chinese. But it was formally, like what we know today, it was formally introduced in the UK in 1863. And from there, it kind of just spread around the world. You know, in the late 1800s, the UK was kind of at the height of their empire. So they spread it around pretty quickly. There's no specific time where it can be pinpointed to when it reached the Pacific. However, in the 60s, the Pacific Games were introduced by the Olympic Committee for the Pacific Nations. And they started out every 3 years and then every 4 years. And soccer was the one of the original games that were introduced. And we can assume that soccer was introduced quickly like that because of all the European colonies and European influence. And that translates to these teams also playing in the Olympics and in FIFA. But unfortunately, none of these teams have won gold medals, silver medals, or bronze medals in the Olympics or any FIFA World Cup. The closest they have gotten was a nation such as the Chile, the U.S., or Japan winning, which they, all of them have territories in the Pacific.
Would you say it hasn't taken off as much because it doesn't really have that warlike culture that rugby has? I definitely found that in my own research.
Yeah, there's like not much about soccer in the Pacific. It's definitely like one of the...
That's similar to baseball too.
Yeah,
I think that's something we've definitely found is they brought it to the Pacific and soccer was kind of more what the colonial powers played. So they've already got good teams back home, whereas rugby with the modern warfare culture was completely embraced.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're bigger, stronger, more agile, and that's what really took off.
I also believe that it's much harder for those smaller islands to actually win in the Olympics.
You
have so little population compared to everybody else, so having star players is a lot harder.
And poaching happens here, too. You'll see a lot of these, even from New Zealand and Australia team, these players will get poached and go to,
I think, like that's what's UK. Crazy is, you know, there's this idea that the poaching occurs from the colonial powers, but it's actually poaching within the Pacific. I mean, the bigger nations, the big boys, as they're called, Australia and New Zealand, are just taking everything.
There's always a bigger fish.
A bigger fish in the sea.
And so pretty much in the Pacific, soccer is kind of seen how it is here, where it's just this, like, it's popular, but it's not really, like, popular. It's not, not everyone watches it.
It's more European.
Yeah, it's... And like it, only one nation in the entire Pacific calls soccer its national sport, and that's Vanuatu. It was an English and French colony.
Where is that located?
I'm not exactly sure. It's near Australia.
Okay.
That would make a lot of sense. I think the French influence is probably more of the soccer, more so than Britain being the cricket and the rugby. So that actually, I didn't know that. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it was a English. So, like, the English discovered it on one side and the French discovered it on the other side, and they kind of just agreed to keep it joint.
Interesting.
So, other than that, soccer is the most played outdoor club sport in Australia.
Oh, wow.
Among other smaller nations.
Yeah.
That would make sense because, to my knowledge, Australia is probably the most successful Pacific Island nation at soccer, especially in the World Cup. I think they got to like the quarterfinals a couple times.
See, I wish I knew more about soccer.
I mean, that's why I chose soccer. Yeah. It's because I want to learn more. I'm all about
it's definitely the most global sport out of the ones we chose.
Yeah. And so something that surprised me when I was researching this is that how little like people learn about the Pacific, because when I was trying to find history of soccer in the Pacific or history of football in the Pacific, you can find history of football or soccer in South America, in the US, of course in England, that's where it's founded, in France, Germany, but there's no like, I had to go to multiple different resources. There's not like something that just says, oh, here's the history timeline.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I struggled with that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like rugby was probably the one where it wasn't as difficult because it really quite is the main sport in the Pacific that everybody agrees on.
So not even all oceanic nations and not even all Pacific nations have FIFA clubs. They're like, they may have like minor clubs, but they're part of like a bigger club that a group of islands may be a part of. And then the last thing I'll be touching on is that we had a soccer player here at NKU who was from New Zealand.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he scored 20 goals in 48 matches.
Wow.
He was the second highest scorer in the U.S. for a while. He won multiple Horizon League, which is what NKU is a part of. He won multiple Horizon League honors. And he went on to play for the New Zealand World Cup qualifying team. Now, of course, they didn't make it to the World Cup, but he could have if they made it.
He's still better than all of us.
Yeah. And he scored twice in four appearances there. And now he plays for the Scottish Premier League, which even that, like, you can see like the poaching. Like, he's from New Zealand. He came here and now he's in Scotland.
Yeah, there's definitely that passion that there's no opportunities for soccer in the Pacific. I mean, we even had Stu Riddle, who was a coach when I was a freshman on our men's soccer team. He was from New Zealand also, and he's now left to go somewhere else. They all have to travel to get opportunities to play.
Yeah, like he had to come. I mean, he's had to travel all over the world pretty much just to play his sport.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whereas you look at rugby, and to my memory, I believe the New Zealand Rugby League is the third best league in the world. So it is up there, and there are many opportunities if you want to play rugby to stay in your home nation. Yeah.
But that's all I have for soccer, so pass on to Logan.
All right, yeah, I'll be talking about baseball in the Pacific, and it's not as widely adopted as like rugby or cricket. Mm-hmm. It's probably similar to soccer, really, but a little bit less. It's widely only played in like Palau and like Guam and American Samoa, but mainly Palau. I hope I'm saying that right.
Sounds right.
So just mostly those nations.
Yeah, mostly American. Just like really, really small islands that had Americans on it, which makes sense. But Palau made the Palau Major League in 1947, and baseball wasn't actually introduced to Palau by the Americans. It was by the Japanese in like 1914 or 1917, right after the Germans lost their islands. Japan took over and introduced it. And then after World War II, the Americans came in and took the island, and they actually started training the islanders how to play baseball.
But they'd already been shown how to play.
Yeah, they've been shown how to play, but they started training them, showing them how to pitch better, how to do field work better, all of it. So
that's amazing how the whole circle works of colonization, that it even brings in the sort of Asian side of the Pacific.
Yeah. And then it's actually the most popular sport in Palau that's played. And they usually have only like championship in their island, just like all the local schools and everything go against each other. And one of them being, that's definitely going to sound wrong, but it's Palilio. I don't know how to say it. They had their first international success in the 60s by winning three championships, two in a row, and then one at like in like 69.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And that's just for the general Pacific region around them, not the entire Pacific. And then, the Palau national baseball team represents Palau like internationally for it. And so they went to the Micronesian Games many times throughout the 2000s, and they won bronze in 2002 and 2006. So they're decent. And then in 2010, they actually won gold. So I guess all the training from the Americans back then just made them really good at it.
Wow.
Do
you know if there's any Pacific Islanders that play in the in the U.S. for baseball?
I think there might be one. Mm-hmm. I don't remember his name. I do know there's one from Japan that's in there.
Okay.
I think his name is Shohei Ohtani.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I might be saying that wrong. Yeah. He's really good. Mm-hmm. He's insanely good. Like, the Pacific Islanders, even though it's not necessarily a native sport, mm-hmm. they actually got really good at it, regardless if it's popular or not. Those three islands are probably on par with college baseball in the Americas.
Oh wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
And usually Palau and Guam are the two like teams that are in the championships all the time, mm-hmm. and they usually go against each other over and over and over again. So Guam apparently seems to be the better team overall.
That makes sense. There's a large base there.
Oh yeah. They have way more American influence there compared to Palau.
Yeah.
That does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. But that's about it with baseball. It was hard to find a lot because it's not as popular according like rugby or anything. And Australia, New Zealand, all of them, they don't really adopt it as much.
I mean, it would probably explain as well the Britain had a much larger influence in the Pacific with their colonization than the U.S. I think the U.S. was a much later influence.
I guarantee if the U.S. took Australia compared to Britain,
they would be
mainly American baseball.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And probably American football, too.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
It's depending on who colonized who.
Who got their first.
It's changed everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they just kind of adopt the sport, and it becomes a part of their culture, so to speak.
And that's about it I got for baseball, so I'll just move over to Eli.
Yeah, so I'm talking about cricket. There are many different variations of cricket in the Pacific, but like all the other sports, they were introduced by the British mainly. And I saw that British personnel stationed on the islands when Britain controlled them, they would play cricket there, and they even promoted it amongst local people because it was kind of a more peaceful way of, like it went against their war type of culture mm-hmm. that they had. And so it was like a team building activity for the local people.
It allowed them to still be competitive without killing each other.
Yeah, exactly. And what I thought was really interesting was looking at a map of the British Pacific holdings that they had, most of them seem to be concentrated within Melanesia and like South Polynesia mm-hmm. with New Zealand.
Yeah.
And you can see today that influence because the popularity of cricket in the Pacific seems to be more concentrated in those areas. So you can really clearly see the influence there. Like, it's very big in Papua New Guinea, mm-hmm. and it's pretty big in New Zealand as well. I believe it's like the second most popular sport there.
It is. I feel like it definitely goes hand in hand with rugby.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Is cricket similar to baseball, right?
It is. It's very similar.
Okay.
It's very
similar. I'm not educated on cricket.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't really know cricket. All I know is they swing like a paddle or something.
It is. It's more of a paddle-like bat, and you have two sort of stations with what we call wickets, which is like these three stands. Mm-hmm. And when you bowl, the point of the bowler is to hit the stand.
Yeah.
And that means the player's out, and the wicket keeper, so to speak, is defending mm-hmm. the three sticks he's standing in front of.
Gotcha.
Okay, so like the sticks are like the catcher in baseball.
And there's various points. Okay. If you hit it completely out of the complex, that's a six. If you hit it and it runs and hits the boundary, that's a four.
Okay.
And then otherwise, if you just hit it and you've got to run back and forth with the other player, it's how many times you run back and forth is how many points you get.
Right.
It can be confusing and it can be long, very long. I mean, a test match, which is played, I mean, Eli will talk to us about England and Australia, takes days.
Oh, wow.
Sort of 5 days of just cricket.
So in 1963, the Pacific Games started to be held every 4 years, and the hosting country of the Pacific Games gets to choose kind of what optional sports get played,
mm-hmm.
and cricket has been played a total of 8 times in the Pacific Games. 6 of them were men's cricket and 2 were women's cricket, and I saw that Papua New Guinea was pretty much on top in the Pacific Games cricket. They performed the best in the men's cricket mm-hmm. and the best in women's cricket. And so that was pretty interesting.
So they're pretty good.
Yeah. They seem to be. And even though cricket is not the most popular sport there, it's probably rugby, as with most of the Pacific Islands. It's interesting to see how they just kind of have this connection with cricket that allows them to really be on top of it in the Pacific Games.
How many times did you say was included in the Pacific Games?
It was a total of 8 times.
See, I just wanted to, I forgot to mention it earlier. I just wanted to segue into mine for a second to show how unpopular baseball is. It's only been included 4 times in the Pacific Games from 1999 to 2011.
That's crazy.
Right. Only 4 times.
I feel like that might explain why baseball is so not too popular, is because they have cricket. And they're like, why would we adopt baseball? It's pretty much like
basically the same thing.
Same thing with slightly.
And they would
rules.
Have to relearn all the rules and everything.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting as well when you look at rugby and cricket together. How the nations have definitely adopted rugby more than cricket,
mm-hmm.
with its, I mean, so to speak, less violent type of sport. And you look at the British colonies and the effect it's had on the world. India is the biggest country in the world for cricket.
Really?
British colony was a British colony for a very long time. And it's fascinating because they were also exposed to rugby. Have you ever seen India play rugby? I haven't.
I haven't.
Terrible, because it's not, it's, they don't have that warfare culture. They don't have the bigger build. And so for them, they were like, cricket, I can hit and run around. That suits me. Whereas you look at, you know, New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, Fiji, Samoa, they would much rather.
They're very competitive.
Very competitive. And like I think you mentioned earlier, Alex, it really gives them sort of an environment to control that competitiveness in that modern warfare in a controlled, rules-based sport.
Yeah, and it's really interesting how some colonized countries, some nations, really adopt certain sports. Like Emmanuel was saying, with India, it was really cricket. Cricket really hit off there. And in the Pacific, they kind of prefer rugby because it really just fit their culture more snugly. Mm-hmm. And so that was pretty interesting to me. But also, Australia and New Zealand are pretty big on cricket. It's generally considered to be Australia's national sport. They're one of the best cricket teams in the world. And New Zealand is, they're a bit more into rugby, but it tends to be, cricket tends to be their summer sport. As with a lot of Pacific nations, they seem to play more cricket in the summer.
It is, they go hand in hand. So rugby is the winter sport, cricket is the summer sport. And I mean, I think I touched on earlier, my dad is very involved in rugby, but I don't mention a lot. My dad actually played cricket for New Zealand.
Oh, right.
It seemed like he's done everything.
He's done it all. But yeah, I mean, he did play both. I mean, he was more on the coaching side of rugby, but he played cricket for New Zealand, got bowled in the head. So that was the end of his career in his teen years. But yeah, absolutely. I think it's also been able to grow, like you say, in Australia and New Zealand, also because there is a larger white population. Yeah. It was a more colonized country. And so as much to say, rugby was more taken on by the Pacific Islanders and the Aboriginals, whereas cricket was more what the colonizers, when they brought over all the colonies, they just kept playing. That was very much the white man's game, so to speak, and rugby was more of a mixture. But rugby has really, really been able to bring the two together. I think we discussed this in class, how well sort of countries like Australia and New Zealand have really mixed their cultures, unlike maybe Fiji that struggles a bit with their relationship with sort of India and that kind of influence.
Mm-hmm.
And so rugby, New Zealand every year has a Maori games. So for that, you have to be of Maori descent, of Aboriginal descent, and they pretty much field a team, which I think 80% of them are already in the main All Blacks team, which is the New Zealand rugby team. So that just shows you the effect it's had on the Maori population, how much they've really adopted it. The haka is done before every game, and that is a traditional Maori dance, and you have white New Zealanders participating in it, which I think is a really beautiful show of unity and culture.
I'd also like to point out, with that poaching stuff we mentioned earlier, you can tell with Australia, it seems like they're really good at every sport they have on there. It seems like they're always in like the top five with it, and it just shows how much they just poach everyone around them.
Yeah, and I mean, poaching is growing. It's growing deadly. I mean, I was born and grew up in France, and you're now getting to the point. So France, a lot of people might not know this, that's actually the biggest rugby league in the world, has the most money, $1 million contracts.
Really? Wow.
Huge, huge, huge sport in France, which I think a lot of people don't know. And so what they're now doing is they're poaching players from Australia and New Zealand to come and move to France to play in these big contract teams, club teams. They come over at 15. They've been in France for 3 years. Do you want to be French? Sign a contract, and you now have these.
So they're poaching the poachers.
They're poaching the poachers, wow. And it's this whole circle of, I mean, it's going literally all the way back to the colonizers in Europe. Of these
someone's
young,
always able to offer a larger price.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you said, there's always a bigger fish in the sea, and so you've got these young guys. I mean, I'm a big French supporter, having been born in France, and I look at the starting lineup now, half the names are Pacific Islanders. You have, right. Off the top of my head, Tuilagi playing for France. I mean, that's not a particularly French name.
And he's been, very French to me.
And he's been there for 5 years, but he goes over because he's offered $700,000 to go play rugby.
You can't blame
him. I'd go over.
And so you're not going to turn that down. And so it's crazy to see the flip of it, how, you know, we're discussing it at the beginning that they're bringing it to the Pacific Islanders, and now it's going back
I feel like they're more willing to submit to poaching too because they want to support their families and everything too.
Yes,
it allow them to make a lot more money than they could on the
islands.
Or
even the ones like on the smaller islands that have less infrastructure and less electricity. They get offered by Australia. They're like, that's just a better life.
Yeah,
hugely.
And then they just send money over to their parents or bring them with them.
What's crazy is you look at these men that go over and play. I mean, not even men, they're boys when they go over to Europe. They're supporting not only their families, entire villages. You look at them, they go over, and I mean, Wallace and Fortuna, you've probably never heard of it, no. Tiny island in the Pacific, 80% of their men are rugby players, professional rugby players, 80%.
Rugby society.
Their entire economy is effectively supported by these men going out and playing in New Zealand, Australia, France, England, and sending the money back.
They must have some crazy genetics.
Oh, insane. You see these men, they're like 6 foot something, even the woman. Super, super tall. And I mean, that's how it's working. Money talks. And I think that's why, you know, the World Rugby Organization is trying to put their foot down, because they're like, you have these teams being fielded for England, for Australia. And it's like, they're not, they're from Fiji, they're from Samoa. Because really, if you did field equality, Fiji, Samoa, the Pacific Islands would be winning every Rugby World Cup.
It basically just makes it, the poorer you are, the worse you're going to do right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, that brings us back to the beginning. Like, do we think that this is a positive or a negative? Do we think that all these sports being introduced in the Pacific, has it mainly benefited them, mainly brought consequences? What do you guys think?
I feel like it's more of a benefit because it allows them to change their cultural identity from warlike and everything all the way over to sport competitiveness to help, I guess, not save their people, but stop infighting and everything and become united as one culture.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's good that, you know, that they're no longer warrior cultures and they're no longer fighting amongst each other, and instead have this unified culture. So when it comes to sports, I think that colonization was a good thing.
Yeah.
When it comes to sports. in the Pacific.
Look at some other stuff. It's not so much.
We won't dive into that today.
I think it's had a very positive influence.
Yeah.
The poaching probably definitely needs to find a way to be regulated.
It also just gives greater opportunities to a lot of people that didn't have those opportunities before.
I mean, I would agree. It's like we said with the education, these young men are being given contracts. They're supporting their communities. It's bringing unity. It's huge. It's pretty much church on Sunday for a lot of these countries is watching rugby. And the money involved, the opportunities. I do think the benefits outweigh the consequences. But like you said, they do need to start regulating the poaching. I think we are taking steps in the right direction. We're having rugby in the Olympics. There are a lot of players that still choose to play for their nations and have that pride, which is great to see. And like I said, you've got the Maori teams, and there really is, I think, going forward, more of that need to separate and have people be proud of their culture.
You even see, like, Alex Grieve, who was the NKU soccer player, he went back to New Zealand to play for that qualifying World Cup team.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I'm sure if he stayed in England long enough, I mean, like myself, I've got New Zealand heritage, British heritage. He probably would be eligible to play for England or Scotland, but he chooses to play for New Zealand. And I think that shows how far we're starting to come. And
I feel like if more people like stop poaching, like they don't submit to the poaching, more likely it'll go away faster, if that makes sense. Because it just makes it too unfair right now.
I would agree. And I think something I forgot to mention about the poaching and why it's so negative is once you've played for one country, you're ineligible to play for another for 5 years.
Really?
Oh, so if you've even played one test game, one match for France per se,
you're stuck there.
You're stuck. Even if you never played a game again, you have to wait 5 years before you'd be eligible to play for Samoa or Fiji.
They still pay them though, right?
They pay them. Okay. They get lots of money, but it's those consequences of, you look at these Fijian teams and a lot of them, Fiji, Samoa, Tonga, it's once they get to their 30s, the bigger countries are getting the new crops and the younger players, and they don't want you anymore. They have to stick it out and wait. So you've got these 35-year-olds who are still very talented, but, you know, they're getting on a bit playing for these countries because they had to wait.
So they really get roped in. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They kind of get stuck.
And so those are the rules they're trying to change, is if you have played a couple caps, so let's say France, Australia, New Zealand, and you want to go back and play for where you were born, where you are genuinely from, they're possibly looking at changing that.
And as seen with like American football players, the older you get, the more you're going to regress in your skill. But if you're stuck there and you can't play for 4 years straight, you're going to regress even faster than that.
Absolutely.
So it's just going to, it's basically just kills all your other opportunities afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have to be that star player on the team if you wish to move on.
And
make more money.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Well, I think that's all we have for today. But thank you so much for listening, guys. And we hope you enjoyed.
Y'all have a great day.
Yeah, see you too.